Andrew Darling here, Mitch Kurtz here. Thanks for joining us for another episode of the Odds Men Podcast. And if you like what we're doing, please like and subscribe. We have way more content coming out and it's all fantastic. Please.
Hey guys, welcome back to another episode of the AltMed podcast. My name is Andrew Dowling. With me, as always, is my trusty co-host, Mitch Kurtz. How you doing, Mitch?
Well, thank you. Pretty good.
You look great. Actually, you look refreshed. I know you've just been away on a little retreat and your skin is glowing and you just look great. You look so healthy.
Thanks, mate.
That's right. Just a little bit of a pump up there for my co-host. Now, we have a very special guest. I do get a little bit excited when we have lawyers on the AltMed podcast. And this one needs no introduction, but I'm going to introduce him anyway. It is Matt Henderson, the principal solicitor at Reparation Legal, law academic at Thomas More Law School connected to ACU and casual academic from time to time at Southern Cross University. Matt, welcome to the show. We've been talking about having you on for a while, so it's great to have you here.
Good to finally get here, guys. How are you both doing?
I'm well. And I mean, Mitch is glowing. And not just because you're on the show today, Matt, but we've got so many topics to cover. Mitch has sort of flagged that he thinks he might be a little bit quieter in this podcast as compared to other ones, just because.
Well, I mean, you know,
exactly. I'm not buying that for a second. You always find a way to challenge the discussion and challenge. So, look, we'll roll the dice, but yeah, we're going to cover quite a few topics, I think, today. You know, employment issues related to prescription cannabis, driving. We're going to talk about cannabis legalization, the industry.
Advertising.
It's just so many topics that intersect here. So, look, before we dive into all those topics, Matt, do you just want to give us a bit of a background on yourself and what you're up to at the moment?
Yeah. I mean, so everyone always asks, how did you get involved with this medicinal cannabis caper? And I guess it comes down to around about 2015, 16-ish. I was in touch with Lucy Haslam. I'd moved to Melbourne very briefly then for a couple of years. And so, you know, I didn't have any friends and I was looking for stuff to do. And it's always good to have a project in life. And, you know, I'd been a longtime advocate of drug law reform going back many, many years. But Lucy then gradually started to put me in touch with various people that had been caught in a bind. 2016-ish, I helped out a veteran guy called Lee Donnellan. He was in a bind where this was prior to DVA subsidizing. Lee couldn't afford his meds. Lee did a bit of a home grow. He actually had the old volcano with, you know, like the dial on it. When he got raided, Queensland Police, they took that as well. About a month and a bit later, we managed to help get him over the line and subsidized by the DVA. He was one of the first. And then we had this really amazing circumstance where the state government technically took away his old volcano. Then the Commonwealth government supplied him with the new whiz-bang one with the buttons, not the dial. So helped out Lee. You would have met Derek Pyra. You heard of Derek, another veteran that got caught in a bind, that bind being 484 grams?
Yeah, I have heard the name, but I haven't met or had any interactions yet, but I am familiar. So, okay.
So I guess after Lee, I was helping, you know, Derek. He got caught in a bind in a possession case, but managed to, with the assistance of Daniel Roth of counsel, managed to get him off with a Section 10. Now, for 484 grams, that was no easy task, but all we really did there was allow the client to tell their story about what triggered their PTSD, their service, and their like 9 years in and out of various DVA hospital wards, taking every medication under the sun, world record levels of Seroquel. Nothing worked. And then just a very simple explanation that from his end, that this combination of CBD and THC in the form of cannabis flower works for him. So that helped him get a Section 10.
Hey, just before you go on, I just wanted to ask you about that, because I suppose I know that you know, we've got a pretty broad audience, and some of our audience, you know, have a long time activists, campaigners, home grow amnesty. And, you know, for reasons that are totally understandable, they would have a reluctance to be trusting towards police officers, judges, and anyone else who's part of our criminal justice system. So when you talk about some leniency in cases like this, I just want to know straight off the bat, as someone who is on the front line in a courtroom, what's your experience? Is it a totally mixed bag, or have you found that judges have, you know, basically got a little bit more empathy than we give them credit for?
It's a massively mixed bag. It's improving, I guess, as more Gen X judges are now coming to the bench, you know. Mm-hmm. So, but it is. It's a mixed bag between your black letter lawyers and your judicial activists. First year law student terms, you know, that I'm sure that you're familiar with, Andrew, but Mitch will probably be rolling his eyes at all that sort of stuff. So it's the same potluck of who you're going to get on any given day. But yeah, increasingly, and I think recent comments by New South Wales Premier Chris Minns, I think, are quite telling, in the sense that when he was asked, well, you were previously in favour of the legalisation of cannabis for recreational use, but now you're not. And he says, well, with this very sort of widespread medicinal use system that we've got now, it's almost as if, well, cannabis, it's medicine. Anyone who wants to get access to it can invariably obtain it. So do we really need to legalize for a broader, you know, recreational pool of people? So, like,
yes, we do.
Things are changing. And so when you got political leaders who are saying that, in an instance where you are able to demonstrate that your client's medicinal use, even though it might not have technically been sanctioned by law, they might not have had a prescription, you know, judges are a bit more open to that now than they perhaps would have been maybe 10 years ago.
Right. Okay. So, and so you've helped quite a few, patients. I mean, there's so many different ways that we could describe
drivers. I mean, after the veteran stuff, we and this is kind of leading into another hat I wear, the drive change hat. Mm-hmm. Hale Pern, Greg Barnes, and myself, we said, look, we want to get a defendant that's got the best facts possible, even though we know that their only option is going to be you've got to go into the court and you're going to have to cop to the plea. But the best facts available, in the sense that they would have been able, look, A, there was no suggestion of impairment at the time, you know, the tests were done, that the patient had left a reasonable chunk of time before consuming their medicine and driving a car, 8 to 12 hours being, you know, the ideal one. And we just wanted to see what could be achieved with, on paper, a pretty shit hot looking team, but with the law as it is, and this is something we can maybe segue onto, because you might have more Victorian updates than I do, but a lot of medicinal cannabis law reform stuff, some days it just feels like nailing jelly to the ceiling. And with the driving law stuff, that's kind of what it's like. We can talk a bit later about workplace stuff. It's a similar thing. Until a lot of these architectural foundational premises of THC detection are changed or evolve, we're kind of stuck in this kind of Groundhog Day where, yeah, you're helping out in individuals that are caught up in the criminal justice system, but a lot of the time, you know, what can you really do other than present their case in the best possible light, you know?
Well, interesting about it is, from my perspective, you know, there's a lot of talk about a blood alcohol limit equivalent in THC. We don't talk about a blood alcohol equivalent in opioids. We don't talk about it in any other medication. I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on the driving piece around, you know, whether there should be a threshold of you know, amount in your system or not. Because it seems that everybody just seems to take at face value there should be a BAC equivalent, but there isn't with anything else that's prescription.
Yeah, I just think we've been looking for 0.05 on the Willie Nelson dial for a long time now, and it's just it's incredibly hard to come up with, because as we know, with cannabinoids across genders, ages, levels of experience, there's not going to be one metric that can be picked and that can act as a universal identifying indicator of impairment. I look at emerging technology, like, is there something that's emerging with stuff like the Hound and various breathalyzers? And I know you guys have had a chat to Tom Arkell about, you know, this sort of stuff. Are we, and it kind of leads into the workplace stuff too, because a lot of the guys that are working in mines and off on rigs are dealing with this same issue. It's a case of, well, we're expected to hit a breathalyzer for an alcohol test. So institutions are accustomed to that. So now they're trying to say, well, what's an instant test that you can do that can give us an indication? And this is why I'm talking about the Hound. If you can't detect something in oral fluids, blood, urine, that's going to be an impairment proxy, is there something that's emerging in a technological sense that can at least accurately predict this person has smoked or vaporized flower sometime in the last maybe 3 or 6 hours, right? Could that be a proxy that work sites, for example, because a lot of the issues that they have at the end of the day with the insurers, right? You've got sympathetic employers, people that have even got forklift licenses that have said, you know, like to their bosses, look, I'm on this prescription. Technically, you shouldn't, but, you know, there are certain workplaces that are letting it go. But what's going to happen if there's a workplace accident there, insurers are involved, and then once insurers get wind that you are knowingly permitting employees that are taking a THC-containing medicine on your work site, but you don't have any certainty or any tests that you've done to minimize the risk that they might be impaired. So, yeah, it is highly hypocritical and annoying that we are not emphasizing. I mean, if the state governments were to write to SecureTech, the guys that do like the mouth swabs, and ask them to prepare a unit that can detect opioids and benzos, that can be done, right? So that is very, very, as opposed to, say, speaking just strictly from a New South Wales perspective, where the swabs that they order will test for THC, for cocaine, and for methamphetamine, right? They can just as easily order a batch that's also going to detect opioids and benzos. Now, maybe politics would just grind to a halt if MPs suddenly realize that I'm on benzos, I'm not allowed to drive now. So, look, I think that you know that there are clear reasons why certain drugs, which are more impairing and are more dangerous, you know. Lawyers, insomnia, we can talk about that very briefly. That hits at 3 a.m., right? All right. So what is an option if you wake up at 3 a.m. and go, oh, my God, should that have been a comma or a semicolon? I don't know. If you consume a Z-class drug then, zolpidem, a benzo, at that point, right, that might put you back to sleep at 3 or 4 a.m., but you're going to wake up between 7 and 8 and you are still impaired. You've still got that in your system. You may operate a vehicle. You may go into work. So there's all sorts of nonsensical stuff that happens both with respect to the traditional practice of how we treat certain, you know, conditions and the risks that, you know, certain drugs are going to sort of give on the road, et cetera.
Yeah, I know it's come up on this podcast a little bit, but we, you know, when we think about the way that the law is written in Tasmania, and for those who need a recap, it's basically same as all the other states in the sense that there is a zero tolerance for THC detected above, I think it's 5 nanomils. However, in Tasmania, if you have a prescription for a medicine containing THC, and in the subjective opinion of the officer that's pulled you over, you are not driving impaired, then you are free to go on your merry way. That's at least my understanding. Please correct if I've got
something. Exactly. That's it. And so what I've been trying to do, hi Reddit, everyone there, over the last year and a bit, is to try and speak to someone in Tasmania that's had that experience, to a patient that has been pulled over and who can verify that what is in practice there in terms of the police procedures and manuals that they have to operate by is police look at the driver, they do the test, they see the evidence of the prescription, and then go, right, on your merry way. If that's the case, fine. Victoria, I mentioned earlier in the arvo that I might have a bit of gossip on that. I mean, as far as we know, there's going to be a trial sometime towards the end of the year. Victorian Labor was ostensibly meant to be on board with all of this, legalize cannabis. I've not met the two MPs there, but through various people that we know, we've sort of, you know, had a chat.
Did Daniel Andrews get recruited as the first participant in this trial, or who's actually?
No, nah, he's on the beers. I don't know who the actual participants are or where the zone is.
If he gets on the grass before the beer, I think he's all right, as long as he stays under 0.05, maybe. Anyway,
but beer then grass, you're on grass.
He's in trouble.
Grass then beer, you're in the clear. Not technically, kids. That's just an old saying. It doesn't mean anything. I am not a doctor.
Do we flash the disclaimer at this point, Matt?
Just as a general disclaimer, I am not a doctor. I'm a lawyer. Yes. Don't make any changes to your own personal medication regimen off the bat of anything I say. Okay.
Please consider if legal advice is right for you.
Yeah. But just to sort of talk about where we're going now with driving law reform, just to keep the drive change hat on. So we're all presently of an understanding that it seems to be over the line in Victoria and that a trial of some sort has been agreed. So for New South Wales, with Jeremy Buckingham being elected up here, my understanding from talking to drive change colleagues is that the legalized cannabis party plan is, well, let's just watch what happens in Victoria. And if it ain't broke, let's just replicate the exact same process that they're doing there. So it almost seems as if driving law reform generally, and I include Queensland in this because they've got an election coming up soon, that it all seems to be predicated on waiting and seeing what's eventually going to happen with this Victorian trial. Now, gossip, so unsubstantiated, but what I heard this afternoon was that there might be some in the Labor camp having cold feet about it.
Right.
Now, I can't pin that on any particular source here that I'm prepared to name, but, you know, well, everyone's getting quite antsy. When's this going to happen? When is there going to be more detail? Yeah. And thus far, legalized cannabis have just been saying, well, no, we've never felt so much love in the room when we were talking about this one issue. Okay, it's great. Well, where's the plan? Because we're all kind of waiting on that to happen so every other jurisdiction can then kind of follow on what happens there.
Yeah.
Please donate to Drive Change. Because we need someone full-time. Because a full-time sort of person doing all of this chasing and follow-up, that's what we're going to need to get every jurisdiction over the line. Tom, B, Gino, David, we all sort of can't do it all ourselves as volunteers.
Yeah. And by the way, I think not to give you guys more work, but when we do get the drug driving law reforms finally enacted, and, you know, I love that Victoria is always the guinea pig. Really, we're really stealing Tassie's thunder because Tassie's already done it. But anyway, but, you know, once we drive change, so to speak, I think we need to continue to drive change, and we need to actually look at and put under the microscope the Z-class pharmaceuticals, the opioids, and all of these other so-called approved drugs, not looking at TGA. And we need to actually understand, you know, why it is that people are allowed to be on our roads whilst severely impaired by these substances. It's an absolute disgrace. And
ask Tiger Woods about taking Z-class drugs and driving. He doesn't remember it, but no, it happened.
Exactly. The old Xanax blackout. But but no, it's great work what you guys are doing. But I think for anyone listening, I mean, any type of legal change where you have entrenched stigma around cannabis, this was never going to be an easy process. And, you know, we've got in all the states where this is being debated and discussed, there are, you know, the roads minister, there's the police minister, there's so many stakeholders that need to be involved in this. And then, of course, all of the, you know, the different government departments that sit under those ministers. So there is a lot of work to be done, but I'm, you know, immensely proud of everyone who is fighting for this cause. Of course, David and Rachel here in Victoria, but you know, Jeremy is such a wonderful addition to the New South Wales Parliament as well. So very, very glad to have him on board as well. And yeah, if Victoria has to be the first state, I mean, Victoria was the first state with regard to access to Medicinal Cannabis Act back in 2016. So I guess there's some sort of a precedent at how quickly the dominoes could fall. Because if my memory serves me correct, the other states had pretty much all legalized access to medical cannabis within the space of about 18 months, maybe 2 years.
Yeah, it happened pretty quickly. It happened very, very quickly.
I love how we talk about it like Melbourne's the first, even though Tasmania's.
Yeah, as I said.
And then growing, you know, Melbourne could be the first, but, you know, ACT is already doing it. But that don't really count. Like, it's just like, you know.
Got to claim. True.
But I mean, after the driving thing, though, I do think that the next hill that we have to take is workplace reform. Yes. I mean, a lot of the issues are similar. A lot of them overlap, like such as the operating of heavy vehicles or driving, say, a forklift. We're still stuck with the Australia-New Zealand workplace drug testing standards with the 50 nanogram in urine cutoff for the first test, then the 15 for the second one. Anyone that consumes any form of THC a couple times a week is going to pop positive for that. We've even heard of, and this is folks who contact me on Reddit, so I've not actually physically seen, you know, a test in front of me, but I've been told that people who consume CBD flower alone, which is still going to have trace amounts of THC in it, are also popping, you know, are positive for those as well. Within blue collar environments, with the mining operators, it's a massively pressing issue there. And what we're seeing a lot of the time is folks who go, well, I've been through a lifetime of hell on SSRIs and benzos and opioids. I've now got my life back on medicinal cannabinoids. Rather than stick around in this job that's not going to let me consume it, I'm just going to do something else. So there's a fair bit of kind of brain drain out of these industries. And so they need to work to fix this, to hold on to the people that they have trained. Some in mining and energy are looking to do that. One operator that I'm not going to name has already looked over the horizon and worked out that we will eventually have 0.05 on the Willie Nelson dial, that there will eventually be some sort of test that can be done when workers are turning up for a shift. So this particular operator has formed a new policy position that any person who consumes THC medicinally for years on end, that these people wind up becoming impaired anyway. Now, this is predicated on studies from 1974, because I looked that shit up, where they gave chimpanzees like 70 joints per day, right? So we're going to need our best and brightest modern cannabinoid science. I mean, this policy and it's like, how are they predicating this on studies from 1974?
Just out of interest, how did the chimpanzees go with operating heavy machinery at a mining site after?
I don't know.
I assume that was part of it. And also, sorry, the other thing that these workers are facing is they've got, you know, this whole push towards automating, you know, heavy machinery. So my sort of thinking, as you've been saying all this, is you should have two options. If there is this Willie Nelson, to use your terminology, 0.05 for cannabis, then either you come to work and you're below the Willie Nelson scale, in which case you're allowed to, autonomously drive a vehicle. And if you're above the Willie Nelson scale, just jump in one of the robot trucks and get the volcano out and have a good shift, basically.
It'll eventually get to that point. One of the things I was more interested in also is FIFO, just as a working environment, is just a hotbed of booze and harder drugs. Yes. I did a lot of work with some Section 501 deportees, mostly Kiwis, but a couple of Poms. And I'm talking like to guys there that their entire adult lives, they avoided hard drugs until they went into FIFO. And then suddenly it was everywhere. Yeah. And it's meth, and they get into that. But what I deal with is, I speak to guys that say, look, if I can have my Mighty Medic and my flower with me on a FIFO shift, I'm going to come home at the end of the 12 or 14 hours, back to the cabin of death, and just be fine, right? Yeah. To just do that, to get my sleep, to Netflix and chill a bit. On your own is never as fun as it is with someone else, but still, as a harm reduction measure to stop people going out and getting on the piss, because there's a lot of time that they need to fill in. If a person's got a legitimate script for a legitimate condition for a THC containing product, they should be able to consume that whilst they are not at work. I'm a big fan of this whole 12-hour kind of gap just to be safe, right, for between when you consume it to when you turn up to work. Other issues that are coming up with the workplace stuff now, had a chat to the ACTU earlier on in the year, because a lot of union folk are starting to talk about this, is, well, what then happens when you've got the worker who fails a test, or the worker who, more often than not, people are voluntarily coming forward because most of the workplace policies involving impairing drugs require the employee to disclose when they've been prescribed something new. When this happens, a lot of the time employers will go, okay, well, we need something from this prescriber. So without wanting to heap any shit on any prescribers or clinics, a lot of the time an online only place is not going to be able to provide something that's satisfactory enough for the lawyers in these workplaces to go, okay, this is legit. This is someone that's got a serious condition. This is someone who's tried all other forms of frontline traditional meds and has failed. So we need to find alternative duties for this person. But when you've got like a Dr. Matty Moore or someone that does a bricks and mortar thing, and they can physically clock eyes on a patient and then write them a letter, that is effective, right? That puts an employer in the position of going, we've got a legitimate prescription here, not a tick and flick. We've got a letter that says, well, if we refer this worker to our independent medical expert, which prior to things ending up in the Fair Work Commission, that is generally what happens. That independent expert's going to be old school, they're going to be pharma, and they are going to look at what the worker's prescribed and say, well, is there something else that they could have tried before going on to THC? 90% of the time they say, oh, what about a low dose SNRI? Have you tried that? Mm-hmm. But the more that, and I know overheads cost, it's bullshit, but the more that we've got medicinal cannabis prescribers that have got that bricks and mortar capacity, it's a bit old school to actually physically clock eyes on people. Those are the letters and those are the representations that employers have to listen to. They have to say, well, we can't just sort of quietly sack them. We're going to need to find alternative duties.
Yeah. It's so interesting, actually. And you're totally right to characterize in some instances there are patients who experience that tick and flick approach from clinics. Although, to be fair to those clinics, if somebody comes to the clinic who's not cannabis naive and who knows exactly what they want, one would expect that the consultation might be a little bit shorter than a newbie. But I wanted to talk to you, sorry, just because we've spoken about this this previously outside the potty, but if you would feel comfortable, I'd love for you to share the story of one of your recent clients, Bob, because that one was quite moving to me. And I think, it's just a fascinating legal battle that hopefully will reach a conclusion soon. But let's hear what you can say about that.
About Bob, firstly, we'll keep his name at Bob the 10-pound pom. Now, I've got a blog at matthenderson.com that no one reads, but it's just there when I feel this need to just write something and get it out there. We came across Bob doing some of our Section 501 deportee work. And when we were going through his criminal history, there was cannabis possession here, implements there, another cannabis possession. And then as we sort of talked a bit more about his childhood, again, I won't go into it too much, but there was an incident of abuse when the child psychiatrists of the day said, you're an off the chain ADHD kid. You're going to go to a gulag school that's going to be run by a certain church, and that's just going to beat you into conformity. So he carries a lot of trauma from what happened to him at that school. He drank a fair bit during his teens, and you know he was getting into trouble on the roads. But he began self-medicating with cannabis to stop the nightmares, to give him dream-free sleep from the trauma and the stuff that was inflicted on him when he was in those schools. And he did this throughout his 20s, and then sort of heading up early 30s, he moved in interstate after a marriage, you know, breakdown. And he found himself in debt to his dealers. And, you know, he was at the point where he'd be able to get by on maybe 28 grams a month or something, you know, so not a heavy, heavy user. He was at previous times in the past when the trauma was particularly bad, and he kind of went through that phase where you have to bludgeon yourself to sleep with, you know, bud. But, you know, he was in a better place at this point. But still, because he couldn't afford it, they basically said, well, look, if you can hold on to some stuff in your caravan, if you can maybe do some transactions for us, we'll give you that 28 grams a month, right? And you won't have to pay for it. So over the course of 6 weeks, this is how long a time that we're talking about. For 6 weeks, he sort of did the bidding of the dealers. You know, he sold a few bags here and there. Eventually, they started sort of storing more and more stuff in, you know, like the caravan. And what we sort of suspect happened, you know, caravan parks being as they are, oh, suddenly there's new people coming in to see this guy at all hours that we don't know what's going on. So someone probably put him in. Cops just sort of went, all right, we're turning up the little caravan park. And, so, all right. And then they went in there, and then boom, you know, they found very definitely a trafficable quantity. So he was charged. This is 2008. The syndicate that had sort of coerced him into working, it turns out that they were quite large, and they were full of not very nice people. So if he'd have talked, he would have been, you know, bashed or worse. So he kept his mouth shut. Eventually, sort of the court case dragged on, 2010-ish. There were appeals. He was eventually sent to prison for a term in excess of 12 months. That's a key thing, because in 2013, 2014, Peter Dutton, as then immigration minister, changed the law to enable him as the minister to deport non-citizens. Should have said at the start, we call Bob the 10-pound pom because he migrated here when he was 5 years old in 1970 with his parents as 10-pound poms. And he just never became a citizen. We're still trying to get to the bottom of it. Everyone else in his family became an Australian citizen automatically, seemingly. But what we suspect is that when Bob turned 30, a letter arrived, and this is after he'd had half a dozen convictions for cannabis possession, just telling him that he was a UK citizen and he was here on a permanent class 5A, you know, visa or something like that. And they didn't really think too much about it. But then as he was coming to the end of the prison term, he gets a letter from the Department of Immigration saying your visa's under review because under this new law, you've served a prison sentence for in excess of 12 months. That automatically makes you fail the character test, right? The character test being, do people in Australia ordinarily expect that such a person would hold a visa to stay here? So, you know, after living in Australia for 45 of his 50 years, in 2015, in June of 2015, this is 8 months before we legalized medicinal use, he was deported back to the UK, where he's got some extended family that he never even met. But that's it. He's got a daughter over here. He's got two grandchildren over here. His elderly parents are over here. Everyone is over here. All of his connections to society and, you know, our culture are here. So when I got chatting to this guy, I thought, and you heard of the case of Doug Desich, the guy that escaped from prison and then during COVID, he surrendered himself, you know, to the cops. He was awarded a visa. Why was he in prison in the first place? For cannabis cultivation.
Right.
So I'm thinking that if Claire O'Neill, and I've got to be careful here because, you know, I'm wanting to keep our powder dry until such a time as we formalize our letter and counsel eventually hurries up and settles it, we're seeing on any view of Bob's past offending, what we've essentially got here is a guy, and we can now say that he's a medicinal cannabis patient because Matty Moore has spoken to him and has given us a very, very good letter. Bob was self-medicating for trauma. He was doing that in 2008 when it was obviously unlawful, you know, like to do so. But we now know from all of the people that have made that conversion over from taking black market cannabis to prescribed stuff, that this has been going on since time immemorial. And we don't attach a stain of criminality to people that are coerced via their circumstances to acquire the medicine that works for them. So if you were to take that big conviction off the record, Bob being coerced to working for the dealers so they would supply him with the medicine that he needed, if you're to sort of contextualize that from a 2023 perspective, does he then pass or fail the character test? So where we're going with that is compiling records from the UK where Bob has kept his nose clean. He's now the sort of person, because he's done a lot of work in therapy, medicinal cannabis, he can take it or leave it. It'd be nice if it was something that was there as an option in the UK, even though it's now legal there, he can't really afford it. But he's someone that's, you know, he would no longer be reliant on cannabinoids to sleep. He's someone that's done the work. But for him to have it here as an option for a few times a month, that would be fantastic. He knows that he will do outstandingly well on CBD as opposed to SSRIs that just kind of slap away at the problems. So in terms of putting a case to the government that this guy's a very low risk of reoffending, the issue that caused him to offend in 2008 is no longer an issue. If he ever feels the need to medicate with cannabinoids, he can go to a doctor, and he will ideally be returned home to WA, and that's near Matty Moore, so those guys can meet in person. But if we can convince the Department of Immigration to view Bob, you know, how we see him as someone that is deserving of a visa to reside here in Australia, that it's going to help give some impetus to eventual arguments for expungement. When we do eventually legalize for adult use, we are going to have that discussion that's been happening now in California and Colorado and Canada as well. What offenses are we going to wipe from a person's record? But I just think symbolically, if we can get a visa for a guy that was coerced into criminality in 2008 because of a need to medicate with the medicine that works best for him, and if that can be sort of tacitly recognized, well, that's going to advance like the cause overall. I look at what the minister did with Darko Desic, a guy that was growing weed and then he went to jail and then he went on the run for 29 years. He got a visa. Bob went to prison and did his time as a model prisoner. He never went on the run. So we'd like to think our chances are looking okay. But once we've got all the documents together, I will keep you updated.
It is an amazing case, Matt. And you're a great man for taking it on. I think the, it is, to my mind, there are just such perfectly justifiable grounds upon which one can look at why he started to use cannabis. And in any case, there should be no shame. You know, he's it worked for him. It helped him. And it's just, you know, such a shame. I mean, without knowing, you know, to the intricacies of the case, it doesn't sound like, you know, notwithstanding that he had a trafficable quantity, you know, that was okay enough to keep him going, but it wasn't like he was the at the top of the chain in terms of the organization that he was, or the syndicate that he was working with. So it's just
that's how drug squads operated. Speaking of which, look at that mug. This is an official drug squad coffee mug, which I can't sort of tell you the specifics of how I came to possess it. But for the person who used to own it.
Yeah. That is, for those listening, you've just missed out on a mugshot. That is amazing. I'd love to hear the story. Sorry, Mitch, we haven't heard from you in a little while. We've been going all on. I told you
this would happen. I said.
I know. But I thought you'd find new and inventive ways to insert yourself in the discussion like you do.
Why would I take away the joy I can clearly see in your face? For those who are listening on Spotify or the rest, they're just missing a couple of smiles and a couple of fingers in the air here. But but I did say it would happen.
You did. Have you got any questions for Matt, or do I just keep on rolling?
You keep rolling, because I also want to touch on, like, you guys are just having such fun getting into the minutiae of the cases. But in terms of, I also want to look at, you know, advertising as part of this.
Okay, we'll talk advertising in a sec. But before we do, I've just got, and I'm only bringing this one up because of the blackboard behind you, Matt. You've got section 51, subsection 18. We're talking obviously about, for those who know the Constitution, and I'd like to think that most Australians would. I mean, it's obviously our foundational legal document. It'd be a national disgrace if you didn't know the Constitution. But essentially, we're talking about the powers of the Parliament and what laws Parliament may make. And section 51, subsection 18, says the Parliament may make laws for the peace, order, and good government of the Commonwealth with respect to copyrights, patents of inventions and designs, and trademarks. Now, I know the reason why you've got that up, Matt, is because the Greens have introduced a bill into the Commonwealth, or into the federal parliament, which will see potentially, if it were ever successful, and there are varying accounts about that, mainly between the Greens and then everyone else, but it would see a, if I understand correctly, a national register of cannabis genetics and IP, and that would be a source of licensing. Talk us through it, Matt, because you're closer to this than I am.
Yeah.
But it's very confusing to me. Just, and I'm sorry, before you jump in, just to say that alcohol and tobacco, they sit under subsection 2 of 51 with respect to taxes. So, you know, we could have a cannabis excise. I hope we don't, by the way, but we could, in the same way that alcohol has basically a levy imposed on domestic producers of alcohol at the point of manufacture, not at the point of sale. So that's what an excise is for anyone listening at home. But Matt, talk us through this IP play around legalizing cannabis.
within limitations, my firm was the firm, though I was not the lawyer that gave that specific advice to the Greens. But I can talk about the underlying thinking of why the intellectual property power, why is IP as a property right so key and so central here to a cannabis industry, both medicinally and future adult use. Again, not to talk about anything too contemporaneous with the present trademark disputes that we've all sort of read on cannabis, but what's very telling about that is it's clear that your commercial position is best protected as an entity within the cannabis industry when you are in the position to exclusively exploit certain particular strains or chemovars of the cannabis plant. And by that, if you want the right to exclusively exploit something, it needs to be protected by some form of property right. Things like sort of germplasms, cuttings and seeds, they're all physical, tangible things, right? Patents, trademarks, technical know-how and trade secrets, they're all intellectual property, right? But it's the IP, it's this right to exclusively exploit a certain strain. A chemovar is a term that, you know, I prefer to use because it looks at the chemical composition of the strain itself, as opposed to terms like cultivar, which are more botanical. I like chemovar because it's chemical, and it's more kind of precise. Right. So the key thing for all businesses in this space is to be able to protect what's theirs, right? They drive revenue and profit off of the back of being able to exclusively exploit certain strains of the product. So in terms of how I view the medicinal market and as like how it's working at present, I'm then sort of thinking, well, if we were to legalize for adult use, the same market drivers are going to be in place. And that is that the consuming public, strain hunters, they are going to want to purchase and consume particular strains. So in an adult use commercial space, it's going to be the exact same drivers, right? Who has the right to sell strain X or strain Y, because that's what people are going to buy. So it is the key commercial profit driving nexus, the intellectual property rights in weed. And this is me almost as an academic because I teach property law now, and I'm probably going to write a couple of papers on this at some point if I get to the stage of an academic career where they say you have to publish something, whereas I just prefer standing up and teaching. It's fun. So why harp in on the intellectual property power as being something that's sort of key in the regulating of cannabis, both medicinally and potentially future recreationally? That's why. It's the key property right. In terms of, and this is where I like to say, if you want to know a bit more about the actual high court jurisprudence and the arguments, and as opposed to, we know that a handful of people in the Australian industry have made use of PBR, Mitch, that's plant breeders' rights. So there's a handful that have used it. It's a limited, right to reproduce a physical tangible, right, of a certain type of plant that you've been able to show that you've been able to keep consistent over, I think, maybe two or three our generations of our reproduction. Patents are a bit hit and miss. It's mainly patents to do with methods of ingestion. There's some interesting stuff happening with CRISPR, but I'm not a big fan of Frankenstein weed, of going in and sort of tweaking things,
doing sort of editing.
Yeah, you know what I mean? So, but, you know, like, to cut a long story short, intellectual property is this, it's the key nexus point for how this stuff is going to be commodified, commercialized, and it's going to be where the profits that make sustainable businesses come from. So that's why the Commonwealth government, in my view, has a right under section 5118 of the Constitution to say, well, similar to plant breeders' rights, yeah, we are in a position now to create a register, and it would operate in a similar way, right? In terms of arguments where people say, well, that's only about the Commonwealth regulating the intellectual property rights in the thing, it's not necessarily a clear-cut right of the Commonwealth to regulate the thing, because it can, it's a legal medicine, but yet state-based law says it's an illegal drug. Now, my colleague who did sort of come up with the advice to the Greens has done the Section 108 consistency tests on that, and he is firmly of the view that the Commonwealth would trump this, right? But we again come back to the political will. It's a Greens bill. Will the Labor Party ever really kind of get on board with this? We don't really know. But it's a good little sort of property rights exercise to just have a think about, well, what is cannabis? What is it when we sort of put it through this sort of commercial legal sort of lens and try to figure out between states and territories, how do we regulate this?
Well, some of the litigation that would spin off out of it would be really interesting. But I mean, at the very least, if it's not successful, it's sparks a conversation. So we're here talking about it, debating the merits of it. I mean, it's sort of, I love that aspect of it. And I love that it's had some airtime in the news and really had people starting to see that there are now, you know, concerted efforts from different political parties around, okay, let's move beyond do we legalize? Let's look at how we legalize. If that's where the political will is going towards, and undoubtedly it is. But no, I appreciate that synopsis, Matt, and I'm going to be following it with a lot of interest, but if I were a betting man, I'd be betting that it won't get up, but, you know, we'll wait and see. But Mitch is champing at the bit now to talk to you a little bit about the TGA's advertising rule.
Yeah, I mean, I could have gone straight into the genetics plant breeders' rights side
of things. Take that off.
Pretty easily, and trying to actually ascertain how you can claim that, you know, the strain that you've grown is different to the original. If somebody grew it before you, that would be in another jurisdiction, proving that you have the IP on that, versus actually just because you've grown it and registered it.
Well, exactly. Yeah. But you would argue prior use by, you know, like the fact is if I can show that is actually a hybrid of something else, you know, to what extent does that have to be a new and novel hybrid strain that stands out from the original?
At what point, if, you know, my heritage is British and before that's British, but at what point does my ancestry.com kind of results deviate enough from 10 generations ago to be its own thing?
You had some Ethiopian, was it? No, something...
For anyone not watching the YouTube, that's okay. Not make as much sense. It's
one of my more wild claims on AltMed.
No, I'm a special Northern European land race. But there's a whole segment on that, which I would love to get into, and I'm sure a lot of people would like to discuss, and how the implications of that would actually roll out in practice, because it seems like a very hairy sector. But I am conscious of time and wanting to just touch on some advertising things, because there's so many people that were actually listening to this, and I'll tell them skip to, you know, 1 hour in and just
I'm psyching up.
We can do a bit of an overview, because I think there's a lot of people. I mean, we haven't even touched on the GMP side of things either. We could do about 5 episodes.
How many calls are you getting a day about GMP washing? My goodness.
Yeah. Anywho. Also,
Also, at what point does GMP need to be applied, and how does it count? Is it EU GMP versus GMP in the country of origin?
I don't know why we're asking all these questions when the TGA has put out very clear guidance, everyone understands very easily. It's not confusing. I don't know why people are asking questions about it. Anyway, Mitch, as you were.
Advertising. So, I mean, look, there's been a bit of chat about advertising, people following it, people not following it, people not following it, people not following it. So I think that there's, he's doing this, but then why can't we do that? But they haven't got a fine, but he's got a fine. But I think there's enough people that are maybe willing to build it into their financial model. There's all different approaches going on here. And that's not an uncommon practice. I mean, we've seen that with CBA and the Royal Commission kind of thing. Like it just depends where your risk appetite is and kind of your strategy. But at a very high level, it might be worth running through the advertising guidelines, because we do have a lot of people who listen based on wanting to get some guidance around at least the 101 for advertising in cannabis.
I think Mitch is asking for free legal advice from you and I, Matt. Maybe you actually, but
I mean, my hitting zone in the whole advertising thing is I stick to the tests which kind of emerge from Section 42D or B of the Therapeutic Goods Act. If you're following the fines,
by the way, just behind you there.
Yes, that's one of the things that I wanted to talk about. That's the section. I presume that I'm speaking to a number of people that are listening to this that have actually physically seen what the fines look like, right? What a Section 42 RDLB notice itself looks like. The overarching test for is a communication an advertisement, and or is it not? It's sorry, Mitch, we're going to be talking about some old school kind of law stuff here. It's basically just another man on the Clapham omnibus test, right? And that means, what would the ordinary reasonable consumer think if they were to see this flyer in a pharmacy, if they were to have this image pop up on their social media feed? What would that person think? If that ordinary reasonable consumer was to see the communication, I'll just call it that, could be a blog post, could be a website as a whole, could be like a flyer, as I said. If that ordinary reasonable consumer was to see that and was to then form a subjective view, perhaps medicinal cannabinoids might be a suitable treatment for me and the certain conditions that I have. I am now going to take steps to then acquire that, right? So it's any communication that causes a person to go to a doctor and specifically ask for medicinal cannabis is technically non-compliant. Any communication that causes a person to approach their doctor to have a conversation generally about their conditions and their ongoing treatments and to review alternatives that they've not yet tried, such as medicinal cannabis, that's technically on the light gray side of, well, it may or may not be construed, you know, to be in breach of the act.
What about the ordinary reasonable consumer that sees a communication and then calls up a lawyer and just wants to have a chat about whether that communication falls within the ambit of Section 42 DLB, as you or I might find ourselves doing, Matt? Is that extraordinary and unreasonable behavior?
Are we talking about a consumer contacting a lawyer about it?
Yeah.
I mean,
lawyers are consumers, aren't they?
Yeah. No, I mean, okay. So if a consumer were to see it, I don't know why they'd want to talk to a legal.
That's every time I see something now, I just go through the lens of, gee, I wonder what the regulator would think of this. And like, I have to say, there have just been some examples that, and I won't name companies here, but there was a fine that was issued to a company for simply hosting consumer medicine information about their products on their website. Now, for anyone wondering what a consumer medicine information or a CMI is, it's that little pamphlet that comes with your prescription medication that tells you about what the active ingredient in it is, what the correct dosing is, and you know who to call if there's an adverse event, and so on and so forth. To me, that is informational. And the more people, let's say, for example, somebody misplaced a physical paper copy that came with their medication, I would think that it's a responsible thing for a sponsor of a medicine to actually make as much information available to consumers as possible. I don't see how that constitutes advertising. Now, the TGA took a different view on that one, and I obviously respect the right of the regulator to have a different view. But I'm confused by that one. Have you got a view on that?
Yeah, I'm thinking that the view of Mr. TGA man is, ha, you know that you are not meant to expressly mention your product names by their full names. You know that you are not meant to mention the precise cannabinoid content in them as well.
But isn't that only in the context of advertising that information? What if the information were couched in terms of, you know, feedback about a product rather than, you know, like
feedback sort of verges over into testimonials, and we know that there are issues with testimonials as well. Look, the key issue here, and I did a bit of prep for this little chat, and I'm sure it's a word that we're going to be talking about a lot, is balance. Balance, yeah. Motherfucker. All right. So I don't think you can swear on this pod.
Hey, hold on.
But I just did.
Isn't the litmus test promoting the use or supply?
Which turns on, do you go to your doctor and try and ask for it? So if I see a CMI for a particular product, is it the TGA man's view that I'm suddenly now going to go to my GP and say, hey, I just saw this wonderful CMI document for this product. I'm just so excited about how to report an adverse event with respect to that product and who the sponsor is and what's their email. And I just really want to get my hands on that product. Is that what they think?
I think the TGA view is that with respect to CMIs, I mean, like in big pharma world, do they normally put CMIs on websites, or are they only ever?
Well, if it's a good that's registered on the Australian Register of Therapeutic Goods, if you go to that listing or registration on the TGA's website, typically be able to download a whole lot of supplementary documents, including CMIs, product
information. They're approved.
So what's that? Yeah, approved, sure. But at the same time, I don't see why, you know, a product that's not registered should have different rules with respect to properly informing a consumer about how to safely use or administer their medicine.
Some of the CMIs that I've seen, I've seen some rippers. Some of them don't have that balance aspect to them, and they probably list a few more conditions and indications caged in language that they probably shouldn't. So when you look at, remember, you know, a TGA are applying like a whole factual matrix test here. So a CMI on a website for a product sponsor, nice branding, imagery, but then, okay, so here's the CMI that's got the product name itself listed that plants into the mind of the consumer. That's the product that I want. Oh, I'm about to go and create an unreasonable demand for a medicine that may not be appropriate for me. Okay, so that may be where Mr. TGA man or woman is coming from. They are also operating in an environment where they've seen a lot of people playing fast and loose. Yeah, it did shock me a bit that the CMIs were picked up. And I know that you raised the issue previously that, it, you know, like you get fined for every mention inside the CMI of certain, you know, conditions. So you've got the issue that the CMI itself might not have the proper kind of balance, and it just And so there it was
it intent. Say, you know, these products have not been evaluated for, you know, or they're unregistered on the AITG. They're only available in Australia via the special access scheme or authorized prescriber scheme, blah, 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 blah. Okay.
Yeah. So, and look, even, I mean, and we know that even just talking about the special access scheme and saying approved by the TGA, if you use the words approved, drugs approved by the TGA on your website, you've got to make sure that that is sort of properly contextualized.
Yeah.
Was it overkill to, I mean, we know at the time that that first batch of fines were issued, it was very soon after an article that appeared on ABC by the wonderful Matilda Morozzi, and questions were asked to the regulator. There'd been no fines issued at that point. So I think that that first kind of batch was just get some fines out. You brought up the issue about, say, if there were people that were getting fined for one post, like an Instagram post, but then they got separate 13 grand fines for each individual hashtag that they put on those posts. Because if the hashtag was PTSD, insomnia, you know, so that's two different indications.
Or sometimes two fines for the same hashtag, where one fine was derived from Section 42 DLB areas of the Therapeutic Goods Act, and then another fine was a contravention of the advertising rules as stated in the poison standard. So there's two bites of the cherry, so to speak, from the regulator, in my view. But I appreciate, you know,
I think ideas. It's a double barrel. It's a double, but it's still part of the one batch of punishment. We think of double punishment, like for instance, with, you know, our Bob's case, he committed a crime. He served his time. So that's it. Then when he was deported after that, that's additional punishment on top of what his original sentence was. Yeah. So, but in terms of these fines, the double barreling, the triple barreling, I mean, there's no sort of rhyme or reason as to why certain operators got pinged and others didn't. We do know that there's just a general resourcing issue there. And over the last couple of years, just with like the sort of flood of newcomers to the industry that couldn't give two shits about what they do on socials, that it must be like playing whack-a-mole. The man on the grassy knoll for everyone, right, with respect to Section 42, you know, DLB, it's in its opening lines here. So if you're a good kid who does law, you'll go to Ostley and open up Section 42, DLB, the Therapeutic Goods Act 1989, civil penalties relating to advertisements, general. A person contravenes this section if the person advertises, here are the key words, by any means, therapeutic goods, or, and this is key again, causes the advertising by any means of the therapeutic good. Not to name names, as we promised that we wouldn't ahead of this, but any operator that offered an incentive to consumers to use their own social media platforms to do reviews of products and post photos of it, that's not been smarty pants and circumventing the section, because those dealings with the consumer, in my view, that's still causing the advertising, right? Mm-hmm. Because you've caused that consumer to upload something to their, you know, Insta or Snapchat or whatever, that is an advertisement. So I think, and I've said it on Reddit, I reckon someone's definitely going to get done for that, just because that was just a bit too beyond the pale and not within the Queensbury rules. You've got good operators in this space that, I mean, are trying to stay as compliant as they can. But then you've got this, well, when you look at what the non-compliant operators are doing and you look at their increasing market position, it's almost, well, has the expense been reckoned? Yeah. Should we have just rolled the dice and, you know, but obviously we know as lawyers, we can't advise people to do that. No. We have to advise them to obey the law.
Yeah.
Or we at least have to tell them that this is what the law is and here are the risks.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, I don't see how or where things are going to change whilst we're in this farmer mode of regulation. These are Schedule 4 and Schedule 8 drugs. They're going to be subject to the same rules as everything else. You know, pharma got around this for decades by just having the sales reps with their wheelie suitcases going in and essentially telling doctors what to say, to doing their advertising for them. We know SSRIs are a piece of shit. We know that it's all the placebo. We know that, right? And it's not that people could see ads like, you know, here in Australia where you can't, over in the States, it's all over the shop. But what the reps would do, you'd have a person that would have taken these placebo drugs, which is what they are. And then at 3 months or 4 months go, oh, you know, I'm not really sort of feeling anything. I'm a bit blunted. And then the doctors would come out with, you need to take Zoloft, say, for an extra few more months in order to feel the proper benefits of the drug. So pharma's gotten around this by feeding lines, you know, like to the doctors over the last 60 or 70 years. So when they sort of jump up and down and say this, all these advertising breaches, it's cannabis exceptionalism. Yeah, maybe to a certain degree. I also think it's an inevitable consequence of the regulatory route that we opted to go down in 2016, that if we're going to try and treat this stuff like all other forms of scheduled drugs, well, strap in. Let's see how this is going to roll.
Yeah, totally. And, you know, but even with, say, nicotine, there are advertising exemptions which have been legislated by the TGA. So they do have wriggle room. There's also the availability for sponsors to request a permission to get an exemption for certain advertising activities that they may wish. But look, I'm very doubtful that the TGA is going to entertain much of that. But as you say, we're stuck with this because of the path that we went down in 2016. But anyway, I think I could waste cereal on this topic for a long time. And by the way, we should once I complete my legal review of this episode, if I think that it's safe, I think that it's safe to name names. What I'll do is I'll do supplementary notes for the podcast with timestamps and the relevant company names that we omitted to mention at the time. So, but yes, Mitch, do you have any concluding remarks or queries about advertising?
No, not really. I actually am keen to. I know I've been probably the least contributing factor in this particular discussion today, but I do think that I would like to get. I'd like to corner Matt whilst we're live and tell him that he needs to come back on because we haven't.
Can do.
Like
we all really, ambush.
Yeah, just a quick ambush because there's like the GMP side is a whole other thing. I know that there's going to be a lot of people that kind of listen to this, get some great great insight, and then come back with 400 more questions, as you would expect in anything that you probably advise on.
Yeah, you know, I looked at my notes here. We've sort of covered most of the stuff that I think, but I did at some point, and it'll have to wait until I'm on again. I did want to talk about agitation in dementia and just some of the tried and true trial and error things that we've done in this household. I mean, I also worked at the Lambert Initiative for a year. I took the job after Reese had it. And at some point there was going to be a study done into agitation in, you know, like dementia.
Well, but
Lambos being Lambos, it didn't happen. But eventually I'm sort of hoping that someone's really going to pick up the baton there and increase that. We can have another chat about, you know, our lawyers' insomnia at some point as well, because it's a real thing, that comma or semicolon.
Even just the thought of lawyers' insomnia keeps me up at night, to be honest.
I think, look, we've done part twos before, and I'd be keen to do just that, maybe in a few weeks. So let's.
If you're going to UIC, I'll see you up there. I haven't made the last couple because, you know, of COVID and other stuff, but I will be in Brisbane in August.
We'll be there. We are coming up for that, and it's a bit of conference season. We're actually, Mitch and I, heading to big international cannabis conference over in Berlin. So we'll be doing a bit of AltMed from Europe and checking in from there. I imagine, Mitch, we'll have to drum up a little bit of interest for the potty in Berlin.
Maybe we'll tee up some new guests.
Yeah, exactly. Could do an entirely German podcast episode. But anyway. Yeah.
Deutsch, aber ich habe es vergessen.
You'll actually be hosting it, Matt.
Yeah, you're on AltMed duties, actually, Matt. But
who you should get on? You guys haven't had Joey Johns yet, have you?
No, we I'm
from Leven.
Yeah, no, we haven't, and I'm very interested to speak to him because his story. Only that I've read at a distance in media articles, but very, very interesting.
If you can get him on, I will interview him. And I know that if you can maybe get this podcast over to the guys at Leven, they might get it into the hands of Joey. So I'll do my appeal now to you. Andrew Johns, I'm a Manly supporter. And in 1996, you threw that pass to Darren Albert that just destroyed my life. I was on that first bus out of the grand final, which is the most depressing place like to be for any fan. And I hated you and the Knights for so long. But state of origin wise, in your commentary work, and then I read your autobiography, and it was one of the most raw and honest and well written rugby league. Our biographies that I've ever read. When you were on the Sunday Footy Show recently, you had a very self-deprecating moment. And I know that compared to AFL, the rugby league audience is probably a bit more conservative and a bit more prone to sort of laugh at this whole cannabis, marijuana. And you were copying a bit of shit for that on the panel. But you just sort of said to them, look, if it helps for this head case, so what? Now, not to throw in terms like, head case, etc. But I know that you've been down the Epilem route. You've had to, try all sorts of different things under the sun. But you've found a medication regime that makes you the most functional you. And I think that Australia as a whole, because we relate to you, you're in a position in the Northern states to kind of bring us a bit more up to speed to, where AFL is at the moment, where it's just kind of accepted that people take medicinal cannabis and it's just a medicine like any other. That, and as I say, since 1996, I've stopped hating you. I love you, and it would be great to get you on this show.
Joey Johns, you heard it right there from Matt Henderson, someone who was there in 96, had his heart broken clearly. And just for the record, Matt, I had my heart broken in 2008 when Manly stitched up the Storm 40 zip.
Was that that game? That was a top game.
Salary cap cheating. Anyway, I won't go into that. But needless to say, Joey Johns and that whole team of ambassadors from the sporting world. We've had Lauren Jackson on, we had Damien Hardwick, and it is really, really, exciting to see, the influence that these people clearly have over society and really changing. I feel like in terms of cutting through stigma, that's about as A grade as it gets. So would love to have Joey Johns on, and if we can ever get him, you'll most certainly be a part of that.
Awesome.
So thank you very much for that impassioned play. We're going to get that as a little soundbite and just send it across to Leven, I think, tomorrow. Mitch, do you have anything?
I can't help but not feel like I'm needed here anymore on AltMed. I think my time is going to end. We've got a sub in now. Matt's going to take over.
Mitch, anything further from you, or are you going to hang out for the ambush, the second
you
episode?
You keep asking me what I've got to contribute. I'm starting to feel, on the outside here.
All right.
I think it's been a great episode. I was very happy to let you guys run, particularly Matt, on this one because he's got so much insight and so much value to provide. So thanks, Matt. We would definitely appreciate having you on. So much so.
Thanks for having me.
On a second one. When you're ready. And I think that, I dare say we'll have a few questions pop up from listeners I might shoot through to you and maybe address them in the follow-up.
So, yeah.
Sounds like a plan, guys.
Amazing. Well, I'm looking forward to it. And yeah, Matt, again, thank you so much for your time. And we'll you'll be back on sooner than you wish, I think, at this rate.
Sounds good, guys. All right. You guys take care.
You too. Everyone. Cheers, Matt.
Ciao. Ciao.
It's Andrew Dowling here and Mitch Kurtz. Thanks for joining us for another episode of the AltMed Podcast. Make sure to hit like and subscribe because we have way more content coming out.
And you got to stay up to date with it.
It was good until you did that.
That's okay. Tight. Sorry.